Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to On Mic with Jordan Rich. I'm he, and this is a bit of a milestone. This is our 400th podcast. We began many years ago and have kept the pace up to reach 400, and I've selected a very fine guest to have the honor of being Mr. 400. I've known this gentleman for decades, and he's truly remarkable. His name is Ray Fournier. Now, Ray's been blind since birth, but that has not kept him from achieving his dreams and goals, creating a successful career in audio production and sound management. We're going to share some stories, Ray and I, about him doing sound for the Beatles, Eric Clapton, hanging out at a little muddy place called Woodstock, and we'll touch on so many projects that Ray has been involved in. He's a creative force with a great sense of humor and a love for his industry, and boy, is he adept at it. So settle back, relax, and enjoy a conversation between two old friends as Ray Fournier joins me for podcast number 400 as we get ready to go on mic. I think I'd like to start at the beginning, which is a great place to start, with you growing...
I had a mother.
Yeah. You were amazing. You weren't just spawned from sheer nothingness.
No.
All right. Where did you grow up, Ray?
I grew up in Lowell, Mass., but I would say for the first 12... Well, let me put it this way. From the first 12 to 13 years, I actually was in Watertown. More than I was at home.
And there's a reason for that. Tell us what was in Watertown.
And the reason for that, of course, is I went to Perkins School for the Blind in Watertown,
mm-hmm.
You know, and so I was there 12 years.
And did you live there?
Of course.
You were a resident?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It was a boarding setup. That's why I was never home. Sometimes I didn't get home except for Easter or Christmas. Of course, summer, I got home.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, did you adapt well to that kind of environment right off the bat, or was it difficult for you?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I mean, even when I was little, I was not at home. I actually was at, they called it the baby nursery, and I was like three when I left home.
Mm.
I mean, I was brought up by other people, let's put it that way.
Now, in Perkins, which I'm very familiar with, we have a lot of friends, mutual friends who have graduated from there over the years. Was Braille the first thing they teach little kids who are visually impaired?
They taught Braille in the first grade on. We read the Dick and Jane book.
So did I. Out, damn spot. Out, I say. Let's talk a little bit about the music in your life, because we're going to talk about audio and all the great stuff you've done. Was music something that also began early for you?
Very much so, because Perkins, it was almost mandatory to learn Braille music. And because of that, we were able to produce music much better, more accurately. Starting in the fourth grade, we had to learn solfeggio, of course, which is how to read music.
Obviously Braille, so if somebody is not Braille proficient, one wouldn't know what the heck we're looking at or feeling, but you're very proficient at that.
I use Braille every day, even now, but I mean not for music, but it was very important in those days if you learned Braille. And they started us in the fourth grade. And by the time we were in, we had music class almost every day. Well, 3 days out of the week. We had chorus when I was in high school. Then that's when you started singing the more complicated stuff. In other words, you better sing your notes. You learn to sing your notes that were written down like you would sheet music.
Where does the mandolin come in? Because I know you're a darn good mandolin player. You've played in bands.
Well, I'm not darn good at it. But
don't be so modest. It's me. Come on.
I just use it. Well, I played mostly some bluegrass with it. You know, I'm not a great mandolin player. I have a good mandolin, but I mean, I actually was taught bass first. Paul Bargus, who was our music director, he was from Houston. He was my favorite teacher. Well, he even, like, started a ham club for the kids. you know, ham radio. You know, he was just a fantastic guy. A lot of his time for us that he didn't have to. Well, he taught me the bass, and we had a kid from England who was brought over. He was went through the Blitz in London. Awesome piano player. I mean, he could even played it when he grew up a little more. He even played at George Weems Club, Storyville.
Oh, yes, right.
He was that good. Our teacher got us gigs, and we used to play dances. Well, he was a violinist by trade, so I learned to play bass, acoustic bass. Well, I can play electric, too, but I actually played the big acoustic bass. And I still love the sound of acoustic bass more than anything, you know. And that's what I loved about Nashville. They use acoustic bass for years into some of the newer stuff. He taught me how to play the bass. And we used to play dances at some of the schools, you know, even some of the prep schools.
What was that like when you guys showed up? Were the kids accepting of you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, we were mostly a trio that did the live gigs. We got $7 a night. We were loaded.
That's big money in those days. Come on.
Yeah, well,
now, did that sort of lead to the career that you had, the sparkling career in audio?
I would say so,
yeah.
Sure.
So let's talk about that, because that's how I know you. That's how I've known you for 35, 40 years. As a producer and a musicologist and someone who's done some pretty impressive live events that we'll talk about.
Well, after I left Perkins, I went to Lowell Tech for a couple of years, special classes, because I wanted to learn radio electronics. I wanted to learn, when I plug it in, where does the juice go? And so I did learn it. I used to repair amplifiers myself. You know, I used to do that kind of work. I didn't care to repair stuff. I got tired of that.
Which brings me to a very interesting observation about this man I'm talking with, Ray Fournier. You have utilized, like so many people who are without sight or without a particular sense, utilized your other senses. It kind of makes sense that you are in the field that you're in. Would you agree? Because sound is everything to you?
Well, I ran my studio. I really got out when I went to work for Bill Handley. And that was 1963.
Tell everybody who Bill was, just so we have a picture.
Bill Handley, to me, was the best audio on the road sound engineer I ever worked with, and I've seen them all. We even got help, you know, or learned from Bo Brannick and Newman. They teach at MIT, and they like design auditoriums, you know, known auditoriums around the country. And so that was a good thing to learn, because, you know, every room is different.
Mm-hmm.
I remember we did at BC in their hockey rink, which is nothing but a cave because it's all cement.
Of course.
So you had to know where to put gear, how to equalize it, how to make it work so that everybody can hear it. As Bill said, you want the best seat in the house to hear it.
Yeah.
Or the worst seat.
Well, it's interesting, too, because we don't have, you know, the opportunity to talk about all the big gigs, but let's talk about a few of them.
No.
This was in the 60s when you were doing, let me just name drop, Woodstock and the Beatles and things like this. The equipment today is so far advanced, but you guys made it work. Can you share a little bit of those stories?
The speakers were humongous. Each cabinet had two 15-inch speakers in it, and it was a good 6 feet tall, the cabinet. Then it had the tweeter, which were horns, sit on top of it. And trucking that stuff around was very hard. And then you were fighting all kinds of weird things. I remember when we got to Chicago with part of the Beatle tour, we figured, hey, good, we got here early. We'll unload the stuff, so we won't have to do it. Well, guess what? The union got mad at us. We had to put them back on the truck so they could unload it.
That makes your whole day when that happens, I bet.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean,
But how do you do sound in the 60s for the Beatles when the girls, and mostly girls, are screaming at a high decibel level? You managed to pull it off.
Well, like Bill said, we thought we had enough noise. We could have made it louder. He just didn't think that it would go to that level. We could have brought more gear.
You could have packed it in even more, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What was the Woodstock experience like for you? I mean, you experienced it. You were there. You ran sound for much of it. What was it like?
Well, not, I didn't do all of it because I actually was only there part of the time because we were doing the Beach Boys at the same time. So I was not there the whole time.
Well, that means you got a chance to take a shower, which is a good thing. You know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in the mud.
Sure. But these are historic moments. Have there been performers, whether they be soloists or groups, who have been especially picky that they, you know, as great a sound system as you set up with Bill, they just can't work with it or whatever, or most people pretty adaptable?
What's his name from the Dead? He was very fussy about sound.
Jerry?
He was one of them. There was,
Jerry Garcia.
Yeah. He was crazy.
Which is interesting, considering he was so high all the time.
Yeah. But we've also done, you know, we did the Mormon Tabernacle Choir several times.
Wow.
So there's the opposite. And I remember we did the shell one time, but our client was WBZ.
You're talking about the hat shell on the Esplanade
the
on the Charles
shell.
River. Now, yes, right.
Bill didn't get his gear out fast enough, and boy, was Arthur mad at us.
Arthur Fiedler, yeah.
Yeah.
So when you're dealing with, it's not just the speakers and the amplifiers, it's microphones too, isn't it, Ray?
Yeah, well, Bill was the first one to use a lot of microphones. A lot of people that were doing sound before that, you know, I only need three or four, sit in front of the band, and that's how they did it, but it was horrible.
You can't get a good mix, right?
No, it's impossible to get a mix. So Bill was really the first guy to tight mic, I would call it. Mic each section, mic each, you know, where you needed it. Like, a good example is like the 1938 Benny Goodman jazz, you know, at Carnegie Hall.
Mm-hmm.
That was one mic, that whole thing.
Right, and a great jazz record. You weren't there, by the way. Well, let's not suggest that you were.
Well, I was alive.
You were on the planet, but you weren't doing sound for Benny.
Nah, at four years old.
Now, let's talk about Boston, because you and I have some great colleagues and friends over the years. And one of our dearest, and you were very close to him, was a cowboy star locally called Rex Traylor. You want to share a few thoughts?
Oh, God, I worked with him a lot. I worked with Rex quite a few years. We shared the same real estate, so to speak. We shared the same office. That worked out good for me. But as like anything else, the rents, the landlords get greedy and they wouldn't double of what we were paying. So Rex moved to Waltham and I moved to Watertown.
Actually, you moved in with me for a while, if you recall.
Yes, I did.
We had a lot of laughs back then. That was a great time.
Oh, my goodness. You guys were so patient with me, I'll tell you.
We're talking about Ray and I having worked in the same industry for a long time. I've done a lot of voice work for Ray. Ray's produced for all kinds of clients. You really had a good thing, a good niche going for a lot of years with Diamond Tape.
Oh, yeah. We did a lot of interesting people. Well, I worked in New York mostly because of Handley, because we had an office down there. But I could do some independent stuff, so I worked at one studio, and I had a chance to work with Leonard Nimoy.
Oh, Mr. Spock, how cool is that?
Yeah. Well, he was from Boston.
That's right, the West End, yeah.
His father was a barber.
Leonard Nimoy and my father knew each other in Dorchester growing up and actually appeared on a couple of stages together, and my dad went on to become a business guy, and Leonard went on to become a superstar, so there you go.
And we had a lot of friends like Sue Bennett, you know, she was fun to work with.
Oh,
she was great. But doing the jingles, I'd like to get to that because these guys deserve.
Yeah, let's talk jingles, man, because we got some good collaboration.
Well, we did the
there.
Original Dunkin' Donut jingle.
Do you remember how that went?
Yeah, but too bad I could have played it if I had it handy. Yeah, I went Dunkin' Donuts so light. I can't sing anymore. Dunkin' Donuts, 52 varieties, count 'em and see. We're the shop around the corner from wherever you may be. Light, so light, Dunkin' Donuts for the family.
The world still runs on Dunkin', Ray.
That was the jingle.
Jingles were so popular. This was the 60s and 70s, right?
Oh, don't play me on the air. I sound awful.
No, you sound fine. But jingles aren't done as much as they used to be. And what was the secret to a good jingle, Ray?
That other people can hum it and remember it.
Yeah, becomes an
really
ear.
Think about it.
earworm. Yes. Yeah, it stays in your head, right?
Exactly.
And can we mention another wonderful friend of ours, the sweetest guy and one of the most talented, J.D.?
Oh,
John Aldrich.
He's incredible. I talked to him the other day. I learned a lot from him, too, even though I would have done them before I knew him. You know, but, you know, the thing is, too, I used to visit. I owe a lot to Berklee School, too, School of Music, or whatever, college now.
Mm-hmm.
I used to go over when they were on Newbury Street, and there was Larry Burke and then Bob Scheer. You know, I was just a kid, you know, getting interested, and I went over there. They'd have me come in his office, and we'd sit and talk. I mean, he actually spent time with me, and the guy was busy, I'm sure, but they were just wonderful people. And they gave me some work. I did some big band stuff in my studio. Yeah, we could handle people like Gary Burton. I remember recording him when he was 18.
Wow.
You know, people like that.
Here's what I'll say about that. And just blush a little bit on the phone if you want.
Okay.
Ray is not only one of the top audio guys ever in this industry, in this city and around the Northeast, but he's actually one of the funniest and most delightful guys to know as a friend. And I think, you know, in this business, at least back then when it wasn't so technically digital and remote, it was about friendship. It was about relying on pals to get the job done and working with good people. And you epitomize that. So little tip of the hat.
You know, other blind people ask me, you know, how did you get in it? How did I, you know, could I do it? And I said, well, you can, but the only way you're going to learn it nowadays is to learn computer skills.
Right, right.
Because things are not the same anymore. When I master something, I do it on the computer.
Of course, of course. As I sit here, Ray, in my digital studio, it's all digital, no analog, although there is a tape deck in the corner, just for old time's sake. But yeah, everything changed in our lifetime radically. But what's necessary, and I'll just end with this, and you are an exemplar of this as well, is creative talent. And you did want to talk a little bit about the young singers you worked with and the jingle people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we had, of course, it mentions in that book that Fred Taylor was a good friend of mine.
Yes, he was a jazz impresario here in Boston. I just sent Ray the book as my gift. And what's it called again? Give Up Show Business? By Freddie Taylor. Go ahead. What does he say in the book?
Where was I?
No, we were saying what he quoted in the book about you and the people you hung around with.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Fred used to hang out at my studio years ago. My studio was in Porter Square on Mass Ave.
In Cambridge.
You know, I cut a lot of the players that, you know, that became famous, you know, from Berklee. We've also done live concerts, you know, Eric Clapton, you know, we did them, you know, we did sound for them at BC. And I mentioned, you know, how hard it was to do some rooms because I got to meet him. For one reason, he blew his amplifier. We had to fix it.
There's always something that goes wrong on the road. Absolutely. Always something can go wrong with sound.
Oh, sure. I didn't care for the road, though. I mean, I did. I was going to go on the last Joplin tour, but I didn't make. There was things going on. I didn't
just,
have it.
Just to be clear, that's Janis, not Scott.
Janis Joplin.
Right, right.
And, well, I met her in Philly. She was performing it at a club called Love, something like that. Well, she offered me a swig out of her Jack Daniels. I mean,
wow.
I mean, you know.
That's.
I thought that was very kind of her.
Very sweet. Very sweet indeed. I'm not going to ask if you did partake, but that's okay. That's for another time.
Yeah.
Well, Ray, we're going to close up, but I really want to thank you for sharing a few of your stories and for giving me the opportunity to salute you because you've been a friend for life and will always be a friend in my heart and such a delightful chap.
Me too. I don't mind, you know, if anyone, you know, asks me to help them, I do. And you guys, you and Kenny, been very, very good to me, and you put up with me.
Well, we put up with you, even though you have the greatest dad jokes of all time. When I say that, I mean Ray's jokes and my jokes are on a par. Let's just say it that way. So you're a good match for me, my friend.
You know, and I worked with a lot. Well, the other thing I did do is I worked in the village with Bill, so we would do they'll have a contract for most of the clubs there. You know, the sound contract, you know, like, the Bitter End, you know.
So Lenny Bruce, people like that?
So we used to do sound for them.
Well, what advice would you have for somebody wanting to get into the audio world today? Let's close with that.
Well, the thing is now, I'll tell you one thing that's happened, is the reason I say they better learn computer skills is because nothing has knobs anymore. Everything is touch.
Exactly.
Like, I got to be careful what kind of a keyboard I buy because it's touchscreen.
Yeah, exactly. It's an impediment for somebody who's not visually adept.
How the heck is that going to help me?
I know, and we both came up in the analog world where tactile sense was so important. Even though I'm sighted, of course, I feel better when I can control a potentiometer, which is a control for volume.
I agree with you. Yeah, because it just feels like it gets away from you. So I still have a good old big console here. I can do 24 track here if I want to.
A good thing to have in your life.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But see, now you can use Audacity. There's some nice computer programs that don't cost money, you know, do good work with, you know. And then there's Pro Tools, you know.
Oh, yeah, there's all kinds of stuff.
They have all those.
And you're right, it's kids coming up who are already very well-equipped to handle computers, so it's a different generation.
Yep.
But the one thing they need to have is a good ear, and there's nobody with a better set of ears. Nobody with a better set of ears than this guy, Ray Fournier.
They didn't know I had 3 years. I did.
I love the guy, Ray Fournier, had a company for years called Diamond Tape. Talk to anybody in the audio sound business from the 60s on, and they'll tell you the same thing. Ray is not only one heck of a guy, he's one of the most talented sound engineers ever. Find out more about this podcast. Go to jordanrich.com. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating, and reviewing as we just continue to move on from 400 to infinity and beyond. Until next time, this is JR saying, as always, be well so you can do good. Take care.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.